Well, good evening. Again, greet you in the name of Jesus. Tonight's message, I don't know if you'd like to know the background of how these things come about, but I really struggled today with this, and I'm not sure why. I don't know. It seems like every time I go for a week of meetings, I have at least one of these episodes where I think I know where I want to go, and it doesn't happen, and so you really struggle to get your thoughts on the paper, and you hope that it actually is something meaningful when you're done. That's a little bit how I feel. Thank you for your prayers, though. I think that when we look into God's Word and we apply it and its truth, the delivery can be less than the best, and God can still do stuff with it. We trust Him anyway. I trust Him to do that. So for a title this evening, I'm not very good at titles because they try to say more than they should or something. And anyway, if you want a title, if you're taking notes and you want one, I would probably just call it Worldly Christians or something like that. And the subject tonight is, of course, about how as Christians we live in a world and the battle of not letting the world affect us. We all have this sense of what worldly means. And it's actually quite a religious word. Like, I don't know, I suppose if you would go out and poll the people walking up and down the street of your town, if they have, like, asked them what the word worldly means, I don't know if they would really think about it very much. But if you ask a Christian what worldly means, they probably have a little better sense of what you're getting at. And as conservative Christians, we have a strong heritage of not being worldly. In fact, sometimes we call ourselves the plain people, right? That's our identity. That's what we call ourselves. As I understand the history of our people, the Anabaptist movement back in the 1500s, which is what we would trace our lineage to, they would have very clearly understood something about being the suffering saints because they were persecuted, and they knew what it was to die for their faith, to stand on what they believed to be true and defend it to the death. Well, as these people got persecuted, they got kind of tired of it. And naturally so. We would get tired of being persecuted after a while too. And so when the opportunities came along to move to America, they took that opportunity. And here we are today in America many years later. But have you ever thought about the shift that they would have experienced coming from a land where they're chased down like dogs and killed? Probably not all of them, but it was certainly a reality. And they come to a world where not only does persecution stop, they become respected members of the community. And how difficult it would be to navigate that identity crisis, because now they're not suffering. And see, when they were suffering, that was very easy to understand because Jesus warned his disciples that people are going to hate you, they're going to kill you. And so that is how they knew they were Christians in the truest sense of the word, because Jesus followers are going to be persecuted. Well, what happens when Jesus followers aren't persecuted? Now who are you? How do you know if you're a Christian, if the world actually likes you? Well, there was a shift that happened in our way of thinking, as I understand it, that we stopped thinking about ourselves as suffering, and so we moved into the idea of being humble people. And we would not be fancy, we would be plain, because that would be a way that we could prove that we want to please Jesus. We're not going to run to the worldly things and do worldly things. Do you still believe that? Are we still known as humble people? Or are we just known as plain people? How worldly are we today? And as I told you last night, I'm not so sure if this is going to be much evangelistic, but it might be. It might be evangelistic if we really can grasp a little bit about what the world is and who the world is, and what that actually means for our relationship with God. It might be evangelistic, but it might be more revivalistic in just the sense that we need to think about where we are and think about the things that need to be revived. So I don't know. You can decide that as we go on. I'm going to quote something to you. This comes from a Mennonite history book, and it is a it comes from Washington County, Maryland, and it was one of the local political, I don't know if he was a mayor or a township supervisor or what he was, but he was quoting, he was quoted as saying about the Mennonites. So this is a man who we would say was worldly. He was part of the political system there. And this is what he said, and this is in the 1800s, so just keep that in mind. So he's talking about the Mennonites, and he says, as to their, meaning the Mennonites' morals, they are like those of other industrious people. They are not addicted to the dissipating vices. They take good care of their horses, but not as a spectacle for pleasure or an occasion of gambling. They exhibit but little of what is called taste. I'll stop reading there. Now, that's not the end of the quote. I'll finish the quote later, because when you just stop right there, that kind of embodies what I would say is plain people. Like, we take good care of our stuff. We have nice horses. Well, not horses anymore, but we have nice vehicles. But you wouldn't say that, you know, looking at us here tonight, that we're exhibiting a lot of taste in our clothing, perhaps. Perhaps we are, but anyway. So our sense is that we are not to be fancy people. We're not to be worldly people. And we still kind of have this in our heads, don't we? I don't know if y'all use this language much at all, but I remember my parents using language like this, that when somebody would begin to, especially young girls, if they would become Christians and they would begin wearing coverings, they would start dressing plain. Like, that was a terminology they would use. I don't know how many of you have heard that, but it's a real thing in my past, in my way of thinking. So what is the big deal about worldliness, and why does it even matter? Like, if you're a young person here tonight, you probably have heard different things about worldliness, and maybe you're struggling to understand what it even means or why it matters, or maybe you're older and you struggle to understand what it means and why it matters. So I thought we would start at the very basic level and talk about what is going on here and then build up from there. And it's going to have to go back again to Monday night's message. And if we're not willing to change into new people, then this isn't going to make sense. Like, if you're not interested in taking the step and letting Christ change you from the inside out, then you're going to be really tired of this message in a hurry. But if you want to live as a new person, then this hopefully will be something that you want to listen to. Turn with me in your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 2. And you Shepherd's Fold men, you'll know this is what I was trying to find. I was thinking it was like 12 or something, but it wasn't. It's in Jeremiah chapter 2 that God, the word of the Lord, comes to Jeremiah. And I'll just read the first 13 verses to get what we're trying to understand here. Jeremiah 2, verse 1. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, thus saith the Lord, I remember thee, the kindness of thy youth, the love of thine espousals, when thou wentest after me in the wilderness, in a land that was not sown. Israel was holiness unto the Lord, and the firstfruits of his increase. All that devour him shall offend. Evil shall come upon them, saith the Lord. Hear ye the word of the Lord, O house of Jacob, and all the families of the house of Israel. Thus saith the Lord, what iniquity have your fathers found in me, that they are gone far from me, and have walked after vanity, and are become vain? Neither said they, where is the Lord that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, that led us through the wilderness, through a land of deserts and of pits, through a land of drought and the land of death, through a land that no man passed through and where no man dwelt? And I brought you into a plentiful country to eat the fruit thereof and the goodness thereof. But when ye entered, ye defiled my land and made mine heritage an abomination. The priests said not, where is the Lord? And they that handle the law knew me not. The pastors also transgressed against me, and the prophets prophesied by Baal, and walked after things that do not profit. Wherefore, I will yet plead with you, saith the Lord, and your children's children, and with your children's children will I plead. For pass over the isles of Chittim and see, and send unto Kedar, and consider diligently, and see if there be such a thing. Hath a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which doth not profit. Be astonished, O ye heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid. Be ye very desolate, saith the Lord, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water. So this is actually at the core of worldliness, because God is asking for his people's loyalty, and they are saying, no, we're going to be loyal to the world. We're going to be loyal to other things, other gods. Now, this is really raw here, because what they did is they actually turned against God and blatantly went and worshiped other gods, Baal. And God says, why? What have I done? Haven't I helped you out of the land of Egypt? Haven't I brought you through a land that nobody could have gone through without my help? What have I done to offend you? Why would you switch to some other god? And he calls on the heavens. He's like, this is terrible. Be astonished. Be afraid. And they have traded fresh fountain waters for cistern water. I don't know. Do cisterns still exist? Are they even legal anymore? Okay, they still do. You know what cistern water tastes like? Horrible stuff. But not only do they have cisterns instead of a fountain, these are broken and it leaks away. And when you go to find a drink, it may or may not have water in it. Who would do that? Who in their right mind would treat their physical bodies that way? And yet that's what God's people were doing when they switched from following after God, who did all those things for them. And now they're going to just turn their backs on him, and they're going to be loyal to some god who isn't even a god. And God looks at that and he says, you know, people that worship Baal are at least loyal to Baal. They don't switch their gods. But my people have left the true God and gone after this false one. What, does that make any sense at all? You can just almost feel the, what word do I want? The incredulity in God's asking these questions. And we don't often think of God being that kind of God, do we? We think of him as being somebody who just wants to make our lives hard because he wants to see if we're worth following him. So not true. I hope we don't have that view of God, because that's not true. God does all kinds of things for us, and all he wants is our loyalty. That's all he wants. Is that asking too much? That's what he's saying there. Why would we do that? Anyway, James chapter 4, verse 4, James is pretty blunt about this. He says, in verse 4, ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. So is worldliness a big deal? Oh yeah, it's a big deal. And the language God uses here helps to give us a sense. Back in Jeremiah 2, he talks about the people of his espousal, which we would refer to as like an engagement, that he called them his bride. They were his people. He talked about them as he would be their husband, right? And he says in Exodus that he's a jealous God. And all of us married people, we know how that feels, that we are very possessive of our wife or our husband. And we should be. And so that's how God views his people. He's very possessive of them. And when we stray, James says it's the same kind of thing as unfaithfulness in a marriage. It's the same language, adulterers and adulteresses. That's what people are called when they violate those marriage vows, right? And so it's a big deal. Well, now that we know that it's a big deal, we need to find out what the world is, because when we read James and it says, whoever's a friend of the world is an enemy of God, well, then we need to know what the world is. We need to understand that. So what is the world? Well, let's try to get a little sense of what the world is. There's a few little passages in the scripture that help us to at least try to get a concept. I think we all kind of know what it is, but it's a little hard to put it into words. So I'm going to try to put it into words for us. In John chapter 12, Jesus is speaking and he says to, the people were standing around, just to give you a little context. The people were standing around and there was a voice from heaven that said, I have glorified it, because he said, Father, glorify thy name. And the voice said, I have glorified it and will glorify it again. And the people stood and they said that it thundered. Some people said, no, it was an angel that spake. Well, then Jesus said, this voice came not because of me, but for your sakes. Now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out. So here we have a prince of the world being mentioned. Ephesians chapter 2, we've been jumping in and out of Ephesians all week so far. Probably will keep doing it the rest of the week. But anyway, in verse 2 of chapter 2, this is, I'll just read verse 1. And you hath he quickened, who were dead in trespasses and sins, wherein in time past ye walked according to the course of this world, comma, according to the prince of the power of the air, comma, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. When I read that, I think what Paul is doing there is he's piling on the explanations. So we have the course of the world, which is being governed by the prince of the air, and that is the spirit that works in the children of disobedience. And so what we're learning here is that the prince of the world, or the prince of the power of the air, we would probably call him the devil. He works in the children of disobedience, and those people that make up that system who follow the devil and their desires make up the world. So that's the world in the rawest form that you can get it, is people that are part of the devil's anti-God organization. And the thing of it is, the devil has been at this a long, long time, and he's very good. He can spread out his goods and his lies, and we have a really hard time turning it down because it makes some sense. Like, it really does. So now, we've decided that worldliness is bad because it's enmity, it's adultery with God. The world is the system of the organization and the people that are part of the devil's anti-God regime. And now, what is worldliness? That's what we're going to talk about just a little bit. Romans chapter 8, verses 7 and 8. Tell us that worldliness, well, it doesn't say it this way, but it says the carnal, let's read verse 6. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. So then they that are in the flesh cannot please God. Did you notice verse 7? James said that the friend of the world is the enemy of God. Romans says the carnal mind is enemy of God, right? So now we're getting some sense here. Our carnal mind is actually a friend of the world because both of them are enemies of God. We can see that connection there, right? And that's one of the wonderful things about the Bible. You can actually see all this stuff kind of coming together. In Colossians chapter 2, actually, let's go back to Luke chapter 3. I was going to take these in order, but I should have started in Luke here. Let's go back to Luke chapter 3. Now, this isn't very obvious necessarily, but I think it's very much part of the world system. Luke chapter 3, verse 7, this is John the Baptist, and he sees the scribes and the Pharisees coming, right? Well, it doesn't say it here, but I think in Matthew it says that it's the scribes and Pharisees. But he sees a multitude of people coming forth to be baptized, and he says, O generation of vipers, who hath warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bring forth therefore fruits worthy of repentance, and begin not to say within yourselves, we have Abraham to our father. For I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. And now also the axe is laid unto the root of the trees. Every tree therefore which bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. What I want to get from here is that part of the world's system and organization is an earthly identity. Say not among yourselves, we have Abraham to our father. This one's very much part of the world system. We think that because we have a certain identity in the world, that we, I guess we don't need God. And I think it's probably a reality that hits a little bit close home for us, perhaps. Colossians chapter 2 talks about the world. In verse 8, beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. So what we're seeing here is that men's ideas, the tradition of men, and the basic principles, the rudiments of the world, that's what rudiments are, basic principles of the world, they're going to be using philosophy and deceit. And I believe that this can be summed up in the idea that humans have the fix within themselves. That's a very popular worldly notion, that we can fix our own problems. And it comes out in weird ways. I'm submitting to you that even this COVID instance might be an example of this. How many people, somebody suggested this to me, and it has been something that I've been pondering. How many people are looking at this and asking what God wants us to learn from this? How many people are calling for a return to God through this? No, we're going to fix it. We're going to wear masks. We're going to vaccinate. We're going to do this right. We're going to social distance. We will lick COVID-19. That is a humanistic idea. We may or may not. God might let us, and he might not. It might just be a way to try to teach us something about himself. But that's a human philosophy. That's a worldly philosophy that humans, through the tradition of men, the teaching of men, through their own ideas, are going to be able to fix humans' problems. And it's not true. It is a lie. Now, we know in 1 John, there's a little discourse about what the world is. And he uses some pretty strong language, too, just like James does. And 1 John chapter 2, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him, for all that is in the world. And then he describes what it is. It's the lust of the flesh. It's the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. It's not of the Father, but it's of the world. And the world will pass away, and the lust or the desire thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. So here we have gratifying physical desires, craving and accumulating things, and fame, popularity, and fan worship. So when we look at worldliness, let's try to sum up what we're talking about here. I would say that in the sum of what we've looked at, worldliness is the effort of humans to find all the answers for their problems in the realm of the world and the devil. Like, it's a system that the devil has put together. The prince of the power of the air, what we learned about. And it's not God's friend. Like, we're not going to be there. So now, are we worldly people? I think I'm talking to a group of people who would consider themselves to not be very worldly. And that's okay. It's okay to think that way. But let me finish that quote. I'll read what I read before, and then I'll finish it, because it's very, very startling. As to their morals in general, they are like those of other industrious people. They are not addicted to the dissipating vices. They take good care of their horses, but not as a spectacle for pleasure or an occasion of gambling. They exhibit but little of what is called taste, and take much more pains to grow rich than to appear fine. Indeed, avarice is their characteristic vice. And all that sobriety and frugality that the worldly prudence one would be so ready to commend, perhaps are nothing more than ungodliness with a grave face and one of the grossest sorts of modern idolatry. Ouch. What did he just say there? He just said that while these people are not showy and they didn't give 2 cents for fashion, they were quite willing to have lots of money. And he said that avarice is their characteristic vice. In other words, if you want to know a Mennonite, you look to see if he's greedy. Wow, really? I don't like that quote at all. That was back in the 1800s. You know what avarice means? Look it up in the dictionary. It means insatiable greed for riches, inordinate miserly desire to gain and hoard wealth. I really cringe when I read that. That is what a worldly man was saying about my ancestors in Washington County, Maryland. So, if worldliness, if being plain, is just a cloak for the grossest sort of modern idolatry, like this man said, then why do we spend so much time talking about trying to live a humble and simple life and not be worldly? Isn't that the question that most of us have sometimes? Like, what is the point after all? If all we're doing is just dressing up a carcass, then why? Won't we just be creating some pharisaical system of bondage and false piety when we do this? Well, perhaps it's a little bit like what I told you last night. When it comes to church membership, sometimes there are preachers that try to control people with church membership, probably. And probably there will always be people that use plain clothes and simple living to mask their avarice. But that doesn't mean that it has to be that way. It just means that there are people that do it. Okay? And I think that for any true, sincere follower of Jesus, we will ask ourselves questions. How am I supposed to exist in the world and not be worldly? Like, that is a very valid Christian question to ask. And if we stop asking that question, we're bound to become worldly. If we at least keep asking it, maybe all we'll do is get away with creating a couple hypocrites, but most of us will actually end up not being worldly. Is that too pragmatic? Is that too just fatalistic? I mean, I guess we have to acknowledge that there will be people that use it to their advantage. There will be people that sit there and build little empires and dress up in plain clothes. But that, I think that misses the point. And so for us, it's an issue of baby and bathwater. We have to decide how we're going to navigate this. And it's a tension that Jesus knew would exist. Like, he prayed for us in John 17 that we would be able to know how to do this. Because we do handle worldly things. We're in the world. And so the answer to this question then is to ask ourselves, or to at least try to understand how did Jesus engage the world? If we're to be like him, and we would say he did it right, which he did, then how are we supposed to engage the world? Now, I do not believe that we are supposed to somehow follow Jesus in every single thing that he did. For instance, a lot of us here are married tonight. Jesus never got married. Jesus never owned a house. A whole bunch of us own houses. So I don't take it to that. I don't think that's really what we're looking at. But there is perhaps some value to think through it that way a little bit, because it might get us closer to the answer than just ignoring it. So how would Jesus engage his culture? I think we can learn a little bit about it. You would have to read all 4 of the Gospels to really get it, but I found a passage in Matthew 9 that I think boils it down to the essence. Because it points out two things. See, one of the other things that you'll find when you study church history, you'll have to forgive me, I'm studying early church history for a Bible school class, and so I'm kind of stuck on history, and I like history. So if you don't like it, I'm sorry, but bear with me if you will. But the monks and people that went into convents, they were so determined to be not part of the world, they would just go live totally separately. That's not really what Jesus did he? In Matthew chapter 9, in verse 9, as Jesus passed forth from thence, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the receipt of custom, and he saith unto him, follow me. And he arose and followed him. And it came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, why eateth your master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, he said unto them, they that behold need not a physician, but they that are sick. But ye go and learn what that meaneth. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Okay, what we learn here, in Jesus' words, we learn that he had a mission. And in Jesus' actions, we learn that he was fulfilling that mission. So when he says that his mission is to call sinners to repentance, how is he going to do that if he distances himself from sinners? He can't. So he actually sits down with sinners, and he's not even at all embarrassed to do it. The Pharisees couldn't understand it, but he said, no, this is what I'm about. And so as Jesus' followers, maybe we have lost focus on our mission. I know I've been kind of harping on that a little bit this week too, but it's becoming very real to me that God left us. Jesus went back to heaven, filled us with his Spirit, and we are to be carrying out Jesus' mission. And when we lose track of that and get all sidetracked into the world, then we're kind of being like Judah. We're kind of just turning to other things, and we're not listening. Now, John 17, I referenced that just a little bit. I'd like to go there. I'm seeing that I'm going to have to hurry up here if I'm going to get through this. John chapter 17, Jesus is praying for his believers, his disciples, and in verse 6, I have manifested thy name unto the men. This is Jesus' mission, by the way. I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them me, and they have kept thy word. And then I'm not going to be able to read all this for the sake of time, but if you jump down to verse 15, I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. See, Jesus is recognizing this tension that it will exist. There's evil all around us, and he's saying, I don't want them to just be taken out of the world, but they should be doing something. Notice verse 18, as thou hast sent me into the world, even so have I also sent them into the world. So here's the truth, folks. We actually have the ability to live in the world and not become worldly. Like Jesus did it. We can do it too. So are we worldly? Well, the truth of the matter is we've been living in a friendly world for a long, long time. And part of the wrestling that I went through with this message is I get the sense, and I'm not a prophet, nor am I the son of a prophet, but I get this feeling that things are about to change. It just feels like the political realm is really strange right now. And I have no idea how much longer we'll be able to say that we're living in a friendly world. And so part of me is like, why would I even spend time talking about this? But on the other hand, I don't know how long it'll be. And on the other hand, if we are buying into the world system now, no matter what you believe about prophecy and marks of the beast and all of that, you don't want to be on that side at the end of time, no matter what you believe about the end, okay? So if we're accustomed to adopting worldly attitudes and mindsets now, as that regime gets more and more anti-God, we're just going to be floating along with it because we're not really sure who we are. We've lost track of our mission, and we've allowed the world to kind of pull us into this lukewarmness and this attitude of not being so sure that we care, and we can be very, very deceived. So I would like to look very practical areas of ways that I think as plain people we can become very numb to the world. And of course, you know I'm going to talk about wealth, right? Because that's what the 1800s saw too. They saw people who knew how to look really plain and to be real sober, and you could just imagine that they are the picture-perfect citizens, but the man still says, you still wonder, like, are they just using that simplicity to just line their pockets? It's so sad that that's the testimony they had. Well, we could get into this long discussion about who's rich and who's not. 1 Timothy chapter 6 tells us that we are to be content with food and raiment. And I know that all of us have at least that and much more. So let's just be real. We're all rich. Tonight, we're rich. Doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what your bank account numbers look like. The fact that you have more than one set of clothing means you're pretty rich. So we say that we don't love money. We say that we know that it's the love of money that's the root of all kinds of evil. And so we do this quick little inward inspection and we say, oh, I don't love money. And besides, I give a lot. And I can't help it. I'm smart. God gave me the ability to make a lot of money. So I can't help it. Like, I just get wealthy whether I try or not. Have you heard these arguments? I've heard them. And the fact is, it's actually true. If you're an honest businessman and you treat your customers fairly and you do good work and you work hard and you don't have a lot of dissipating vices like gambling and smoking and all of those things, yeah, wealth has a way of stacking up. It actually does. But you know, God isn't nearly as concerned about the $200 you give in the offering as he is the $2,000 that you stashed or spent on some selfish pursuit. And I think that's the key there. And besides, none of us, I think it's safe to say that none of us keep a lot of things that we don't love. And so if we find that money keeps accumulating and wealthy investments and lots of material goods just keep building up and building up and building up, and we deny that we love it. I don't keep a lot of things around that I don't love. If I truly hate it, it's not in my house. And so I think we need to be a little more real with wealth. We love it. Because here's what it does. Here's the lie. Why is wealth so tempting? Why is it so much? See, wealth offers us comfort and security. And that's the world's way of looking at wealth. You need to have life insurance. You need to have investments. You need to have all of this because what if you'll need it someday? And the lie is that somehow is going to make you secure. And the truth is that riches can grow wings and fly away. And even if you're a billionaire, depending on the situation and the circumstances, you see, the people back in the 20s and 30s knew this. There were people that lost thousands of dollars within 24 hours. So we're pretty insulated from that. We think all the insurances that our government offers us and everything is going to keep us from that, but that's all worldly. And so my point tonight, people, is that it's a worldly concept to trust wealth. It is a worldly idea to think that we have to invest and to keep investing and to keep making more and to keep, you know, insuring everything to the hilt so that we're insulated against any loss. That is all very worldly. And as plain people, I'm afraid we might be losing our way. Because we hardly know when to say enough is enough. We hardly know what to do whenever we are building a big
project, or we're investing a lot of money, and we're tempted to take out the insurance on that because we don't really know how to trust God to take care of those things. And we're not really sure if we're okay with God taking it away. So we have this backup, this cushion that helps insulate us from that. I could talk a long time about this. This is a huge subject, and it's very real. And one of the things that I want to say in a message like this is that my words can make me sound better than I am. I struggle with this as well. Like, I understand how difficult it is to know how to navigate the whole issue of money and material possessions and what's necessary and what isn't. And I actually wrestled with preaching a whole message on this. That was part of the wrestling today. I thought about talking about just this issue, but I didn't feel like that was the right way to go. So here we are. You're going to have to sit just a little bit longer. Another area that I believe we may be losing our way. I think that the man in the 1800s might not be able to say that we care nothing for taste anymore. I'm afraid that the fashions of the world have actually affected us some. The world has all kinds of show and pomp and popularity, and it's all tied up in the decoration of the world. We call it the pride of life. And we live very nicely. We have nice things. We have nice clothes. And I am not here saying that there is godliness in sloppiness. Okay? I'm not saying that at all. I've heard that idea kind of floated here and there, and I do not agree with it. I think that if you have a house that needs paint, you should paint it. There is no righteousness in letting it fall to the ground. All right, so let's just get that out of the way. But you know what I'm talking about when I say we take it to the next level. Okay, we do, and we may as well admit it. And one of the things that I hear too is that, well, we got it cheap. Does that change anything? If the world sees a certain make of vehicle as being a luxury vehicle or a sports vehicle, or it puts you into some kind of category, does it matter if you got it for free? You see, the lie here, the lie behind fashion, is that if I have the right things, I will belong and I will have an identity. That's the lie. And it's partially true, it's a little bit true, just like money is a little bit true that it gives you security. It's a little bit true that you'll have identity, but the identity won't be the right identity. It's not the identity of a child of God. And it appeals to us to want to belong somewhere. And it can be a little fringe group, or it can be the big popular group. How practical shall I get with this? When we have to have the pickup truck with the tires that stick out 3 or 4 inches from the side, and it's obviously oversized tires, and it's lifted, and it's modified exhaust and all that, young men, old men, what are we doing with that? Who is actually calling the shots on why we did that? And we might say, oh, well, I like it, but why do we like it? It's because we're buying into the idea that that's going to give me some prestige in the world. And that's, you know, it doesn't just have to be vehicles. That's just a big one right now. Vehicles are a big thing. Technology use is a big thing. You know, I have purpose that I use Apple products, but I have purpose that I will never buy, and this is just a personal thing. You don't have to take this. I'm just telling you how I process these things. But I will never buy a brand new iPhone. And the reason for that is because I don't want people to think that I am standing in line at the latest release of iPhone. It's like, why do I care what people think? See, the other thing that it does is it informs me about who I am, right? My affections are not tied to the latest iPhone because I have told myself I'm not going to get it. So my iPhones have to be at least one model old or older. And you know what? People that know iPhones know that. They do. And this could come into our clothing and all that kind of thing. And I'm going to get a little bit obnoxious here on this subject. We men, I think, have a problem. And that is that we let our wives bear a lot of the brunt of making statements about identity as a separated people. And we spend a lot of time at ministers' meetings and so on. Now, ladies, just don't listen real hard right now. But we spend a lot of time talking about sleeve endings and all the little fancy things that they want to do to their dresses, and we say, no, we don't want that. But our ladies could put the fanciest sleeve endings on their dress and still be more separate in their appearance than we are. The reason we're concerned about the sleeve endings, though, ladies, is because we're concerned about where your affections are. Okay, it's the same reason we're worried about why young men and old men want to doll up their vehicles and build big houses and things like that. It's because it's an issue of who are we serving? How are we living in the world? And every time we make a choice to engage with the world, we are purposely walking into a battlefield. And if we're going to be victorious in our affections, we're going to have to make some conscious, practical decisions about how much of the world we will allow to dictate to us what we do. And it's hard, like it's a real battle, and it doesn't go away. Let's talk about amusement a little bit. I want to read you some startling verses in 1 Peter. Chapter 4. First Peter 4. Let's start in at verse 1. For as much then as Christ hath suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves likewise with the same mind, for he that hath suffered in the flesh hath ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh to the lusts of men, but to the will of God. For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lasciviousness, lust, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries, wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you, who shall give account to him that is ready to judge the quick and the dead. Okay, Peter can kind of ramble a little bit, but what he's saying here is that we are new people. I'm still on that whole thing. We are new people. We don't live the way we used to. Christ has suffered in the flesh, and we are to bring ourselves into that same mindset, because when we choose to forego fleshly desires, we make a practical break from sin. That is how I understand verse 1. And we are not going to live the rest of our life to the desires of men. We have a new purpose. It's to the will of God. Because we've spent enough time there. That's what verse 3 is saying. And here's what he says. People are going to think it's weird that you don't run around doing the same things they do. Notice that word riot. That's the word that stuck out to me. I think that would be like revelings or reckless partying. I think that's what that probably means. Now, did you know that verse shows up in 2 Peter 2? I did not know that till I was studying this today. I mean, I guess I knew it, but it never really meant that much to me. But if you go to 2 Peter chapter 2, this is in another discourse of Peter's, and he's talking about people who are unrighteous, they are unjust, and they are reserved to the day of judgment, and they walk in the lust of uncleanness. I'm in verse 10. They're presumptuous, arrogant. It means that they think they can do anything and get away with it. They're self-willed. They're not afraid to speak evil of dignities, but even angels are afraid to talk about them. Verse 12, they're like animals. And they speak evil of things that they don't understand, and they're going to perish. But listen to verse 13. And shall receive the reward of unrighteousness as they that count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Like, these people are just bold and arrogant with their sin. Now, rioting, as I said, I believe it has the idea of partying or reveling. And the world offers no end to options to amuse ourselves. What is so tempting about amusement? Remember, we talked about wealth. The thing that's so tempting about that is the security that it offers. The thing that's so tempting about fashion is the identity that it offers. The thing that's so tempting about amusement is the insulation from reality that it offers. Why can these people do all these things? Why can they be the ones that are just arrogant and self-willed and speaking evil of dignities, things that angels don't even do? It's because they've amused themselves to the point that they can just ride in the daytime. They're not even ashamed of what they do anymore. They're not even thinking about reality anymore. And I'm afraid that as plain people, again, by opening ourselves to the internet as we have opened ourselves to worldly knowledge and amusements in a way that I don't think we have seen the fruit yet. And I don't know that we can change that. I think that every time I talk about this, somebody says, well, why don't you just say no to the internet? And it's a complicated question. It's very complicated. It's not all that easy to just say no to the internet. But we must understand that this takes the tension of being in the world and not of the world to a whole other level. It is now hanging on the side of our belts, whereas you might have had to run downtown 20, 50 years ago to be involved in everything that the world has to offer as far as amusement. But see, insulating ourselves from reality, it dulls the pain of life and it keeps us from turning to Jesus Christ to find the answers. And so we have entertainment, we have movies, we have books, we have all those things. And the Bible is calling us to live life seriously. We are to ponder the path of our feet. We're to keep our hearts with all diligence, and amusement will push back against that. I'm afraid that recreation has become too much of a god to us. Now, I am not opposed to recreation in the sense that you actually become refreshed by taking a break from your regular duties. We have people that play volleyball at Bible school. That's perfectly fine. You're playing volleyball to get a break and to move your arms and legs around after sitting around studying all day. And if you're out working all day and you want to take a couple of minutes and sit in the hammock and read or something like that, I get that kind of recreation. But the kind of recreation that now is a big deal, and I'm just amazed that we've even thought that this is okay. But why would we say that recreation is taking a bunch of side-by-sides and four-wheelers out into the mud pits and going mudding? What is godly about that? How is that going to build the kingdom of God in any way? How does that actually recreate you? How does it steward the earth? Or does it actually destroy the earth and use up resources? Let's think about these things, folks. And I know that when preachers get practical, they get... you know, they never get invited back again. But it's real. What about truck pulls, truck shows? I'm even going to call out swimming. And the reason I'm going to call it out is because I'm not convinced that modesty is only between opposite genders. And the other thing is, in our day, with the push for homosexuality being more and more okay, and also with the pressure on you young ladies, I'm going to be really bold here, but there's a lot of pressure about how you look. And the more clothing you take off, the more pressure you're going to put on that. I'm just concerned that we think through the way we do things. And how are we going to build the kingdom? Are we truly living as new people when we do these things? I'm not saying that all swimming is wrong. I'm just calling it out, because I think that if we're not careful, we will run to the same excess of riot and amuse ourselves to death with some of these things. I'm concerned with the level of acceptance of guns and how anxious I have heard some young men become when they think about the Second Amendment being repealed. Why do non-resistant people care if you can't carry a handgun hidden in your belt? Why do they care? I don't know if you all have these issues or not. These are things I hear. I don't know if I've heard them from people of Providence or not. It's not like I just think that as plain people, as people who are trying to find a way to live simply and humbly in the world, we've got to start talking about these things. Let's talk about one other area that I think we should consider, and that is this whole thing of worldly power and politics. As conservative Anabaptist people, we have seen value in pulling away from politics. It hasn't always been so. And when you read Mennonite history, you'll find that there were Mennonite men who served on political boards in this area, Lancaster and Lebanon area, and possibly other places. But we got away from that. And I think we should have. I think that the way we view our involvement in politics as being just removed from it is something that is good. Because the political power brokering of the world is probably the worldliest thing you can do. Like, that's even more worldly than some of the other things I've mentioned. Because that is getting right into Satan's territory. He wants to rule the world. And he wants his people to do his job for him, just like Jesus wants his people to do his job for him. This is where the battle gets really raw. And that's why I am so concerned about my tendency, and apparently other people's tendency from the conversations I hear, to get trapped in this idea that politics will fix politics problems. It won't. And when we start thinking that somehow we've got to get the right candidates in, we are losing our way rapidly. Politics will never fix politics problems. Just like humans will never find answers to human problems. We need something bigger, and we need something outside of ourselves. And Jesus has a kingdom, and he has people. He's calling people into it, and he says, I want you to live in the world, but I want you to do my work, and it's not going to be controlling the world. And this is where, again, things like self-defense and all the trappings of protecting our assets and all of that, this is really where it comes in. And I'm afraid that we are not thinking through it correctly sometimes. I know that it's been a struggle for me in the last little while, and I've had to just stop reading news articles. Because those people have a way of writing, and then if you actually go to the next level and start listening to people talk about it on your podcast, or whether maybe you sit and watch YouTube videos, I don't know. I know that's a reality for some people. And Tucker Carlson makes a lot of sense when he talks, but he's of the world. He really is a worldly man, even though his conservative viewpoint might make sense to us. Okay. So what can we do about all of this? I'm sure there's more things, but those are four areas that I'm really, really concerned about for us. And again, I ask the question, are the reasons we would push back on this valuable? Are they valid? Are they really tied to Christian principles? I submit to you, yes, they are. They are. There's a reason that we think that we should not live that way. So what can we do about it? Well, step one, I think we need to remember that worldliness is enmity with God. Let's just start at the basics again. We cannot love the world and love God at the same time. 1 John is perfectly clear on that. He that loves the world does not have the love of the Father in him. It just doesn't work. Jesus said, no man can serve two masters. No person can truly be faithful to two lovers at one time. It is just not possible. So to go back to the marriage analogy, like God does way back, you can't do it. As soon as you switch to another lover, you have been unfaithful. And when we switch to worldliness, we are at odds with God. Number two, we need to stop using other people as measuring sticks. We need to go back to the real measuring stick and stop using people as measuring sticks. We need to have the ability to say that there are things that we will not allow ourselves to do. It doesn't matter if Tom, Dick, and Harry does it. It doesn't matter. Number three, we need to focus on our choices and examine our lives and intents. We need to live life after the Spirit and not after the flesh. And the question, I can do this, or can I do this and still be a Christian, is a really bad question to ask. It's a little bit like saying, can I go out for dinner with a woman that's not my wife and still be faithful to my wife? And if you answer yes to that question, well, can I? Well, you see where this is going to go, right? Like, that is just foolishness in the extreme. Like, what a dumb question. But I kind of think that that's the same question that we ask when we start saying, well, can I do this and still be a Christian? Well, maybe technically, but why would you ask that question? Like, what does it imply? It implies that you're thinking about doing something that might be a little bit questionable, right? Number four, I think we need to be more open to our brotherhood. I wonder if we were, okay, one of the things that's tricky about living in this tension, is that we can justify anything to ourselves. I don't know if you've ever experienced this or not, but maybe you've come to the place where you've decided to do something, purchase something, add on to your business, or, yeah, whatever. There's something you've decided to do. But you would really rather not just go public with it. Like, you can kind of justify it to yourself, but depending on who would walk in when you're using it, you would be kind of wishing it was kind of out of the way. Does that not give us any guidance at all? I think it does. Like, if I would be embarrassed if Brother Luke saw something that I have, that tells me something about what I'm doing. And I think that sometimes we have hurt ourselves by too much individualism. And so, you know, really practical. Maybe we should ask or go to a brother's meeting and say, you know, I'm thinking about taking this vacation out west to go elk hunting. What do y'all think about that? Would the question even come up? Or maybe the ladies should have a sister's meeting and say, I'm thinking about adopting this new dress pattern. What do you think? Is this going to be helpful to me and to everybody else? That I'm smiling a little bit because it seems like it's so far-fetched. And yet I guarantee you that kind of accountability, if we were truly willing to take it to that level, we would pretty much fight the battle all at once. Like, it would really solve some problems in my life, I'm pretty sure. And finally, I'm going to keep coming back to this. I think if we need a revival tonight, it's a revival for the vision for which we were placed in the world. We are here to do God's work. I don't think I can emphasize that enough. It's been something that's just been so clear to me, and I don't do it very good. When I think about my life, I don't think that I do God's work very well. But I want to, because that's what He expects of me. If I'm going to truly be Jesus' follower, then I have got a job to do. And all the resources and all the things that the world has, I may use in His kingdom. I say all the things, but you understand what I mean. The things we talked about here tonight, like our wealth, it has got to become a tool in this work that can never become the work itself. And I just can't emphasize that enough. We have a job to do, and it's not pleasing ourselves. It's not living after the world. And if we find ourselves in that area, if there's areas in our life where we're just buying into the world system and we're just living according to the prince of the power of the air, the children of disobedience, and the running after the lusts of uncleanness, and we're becoming these presumptuous people that aren't even afraid to ride in the daytime, I think we will do an invitation tonight, and I want you to think about where you are. And if you feel like you're not where you should be, and you want help, somebody will help you. So what's the psalm?